Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. Thanks for listening to the podcast. And a warm welcome to the show. It's 4 minutes after the hour. Thanks for joining me today. Bill Arnold here. We've got a great hour planned. Dr. Paul Kengor is already on the studio line, so I will try to keep him waiting as long as possible. And then Patrick Albanese will be with us in the second half of the hour, so it's going to be a great hour. I want to hear from missionaries. If you've got a great story from having worked in the missions field, maybe you served as a missionary and you've got a great story, I'd love to hear it. And if you've done a short-term missions trip and you think, okay, God worked in the most phenomenal way, we would like to hear it as well. So would you mind emailing me that story, bill@myfaithradio.com? I would like to periodically share interesting and encouraging stories from people that have done missionary work or have been on the mission field with a great story. You may know the story of Robert and Mary Moffat. They were missionaries in Africa. They labored for, I think, 10 years in Botswana without one ray of hope, of encouragement, nothing. They couldn't report a single convert. And then finally, their little missions board started to question the wisdom of them even staying there and continuing their work. But the thought of them leaving their post was brought great grief to them. So they stuck around for another year or two, and nothing but darkness reigned. Nothing, no response. And then one day, a friend from England sent word to them as a way to encourage them to say, we'd like to send you a gift. What would you like? And Mrs. Moffat, trusting in that in time God would bless their work, she said, send us a communion set. I'm sure it'll be needed. And God certainly did honor that couple's faith. The Holy Spirit did move upon the hearts of these villagers. And soon a little group of six converts were united to form the first Christian church in that land. And, of course, the communion set from England was delayed in the mail. But on the very day before the first commemoration of the Lord's Supper, the set arrived. So God is always working faithfully and in his perfect time. So if you have a heart for somebody, maybe you've been praying for somebody for years and years, and you're wondering, am I making a difference? Just trust God's timing. We'll take a little break. When we come back, Dr. Paul Kengor is with us. Looking forward to getting him on the line. Be back in a minute.
Your prayers matter and are heard by God. When you pray, lives can be changed. Each week, the Faith Radio prayer team joins together to pray for relationships to be strengthened, finances to be increased for God's glory, for our leaders to follow God's will, and for so much more. Will you join us? The Faith Radio prayer team, made up of hundreds of listeners, receives an email with each week's prayer focus. You can be a part of the Faith Radio prayer team by signing up at myfaithradio.com.
A recent study showed that we touch our cell phones 2,617 times per day. A few of those touches can make a real positive difference in your life when you use the free Faith Radio app. You can download the app by searching for Faith Radio in iTunes or Google Play, then start listening to the live stream or past programs right away. The free Faith Radio app. Download it to any connected device today.
Welcome back. Dr. Paul Kengor is a professor of political science at Grove City College and senior director of the college's Center for Vision and Values, the New York Times bestselling author of over a dozen books. His latest book, The Politically Incorrect Guide to Communism, is out, and he's with us today. Hello, Paul.
Hey, Bill. How you doing?
I'm doing great. How are you doing?
Doing pretty good. Pretty good.
You always make me happy when you come on the show because you are like such a great guest, just so you know.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it. You make me happy because you are a great host.
Ah, there we go. We've pat each other on the back. This is good. All right, congratulations.
I do sincerely mean that. You're a good host.
Oh, thank you. Now, congratulations on your newest book, The Politically Incorrect Guide to Communism. And it's so interesting with the rise of socialism on the left that there is an interest. And I don't know if we... maybe you would tell us the difference between socialism and democratic socialism and communism. Kind of a big loaded first question.
Sure. Well, it's a long answer, but I guess the short answer, Bill, would be that in strict Marxist theory, socialism is just one of the roads on the way to full communism.
Mm-hmm.
So you go from basically feudalism to capitalism to socialism to communism. So socialism would be a kind of a way station, a temporary transitionary phase on the way to full communism. And you know, you have people today who say things like, oh, I'm not a communist or a Marxist, or I'm not even a socialist. I'm a democratic socialist, right? And they don't even realize that Lenin, Trotsky, and Stalin, they were all part of the Russian Social Democratic Labor Party. And you know, that was before they met in 1903 in Brussels and London. And they split into the Bolsheviks, which was the majority, and the Mensheviks, which was the minority. But they were social democrats, too. They were democratic socialists. So Herbert Marcuse, one of the founding fathers one of the leading philosophers of the Frankfurt School of Cultural Marxism, called himself a democratic socialist. So there's not a lot of difference. There are nuances. And it's funny that some people on the democratic socialist side would swear up and down that they have nothing in common with any of those people that I mentioned, but actually they do have a lot in common. And it's not to say that you know, they're future Leninists and Stalinists and dictators who are going to go murder people, but certainly things like the common ownership of the means of production and the way they view class, unions, redistribution of wealth, collectivization, they're actually a lot in common.
You know, Paul, I would love for you to take a couple of minutes and give a mini lecture from Professor Paul on putting this in perspective, because there are lots of interest now in the socialists and socialism, and it is a slippery slope, just the way you explained it, from socialism to democratic socialism to communism. I mean, it can be a slippery slope. So maybe you would give us a little mini lecture on the pure evils of communism.
Well, and not only is it a slippery slope, Bill, but it's really an evolutionary slope. I mean, that's how they saw it. And Marx, who was a strict Darwinian and evolutionist, in fact, in the eulogy at Marx's funeral, which was given by Engels, Engels quoted Darwin, and you know, they thought that they were doing for the economics, for the social sciences, what Darwin had done for the hard sciences. So they had this evolutionary veneer to what they were doing. And they call it scientific socialism. And for that matter, in the 1970s in the Soviet Union, Leonid Brezhnev and the boys would call this real socialism. And the USSR, as you know, Bill, the second S in the USSR stood for socialist. So you know, here again, a lot of these words are actually used interchangeably. It's kind of funny. Over the weekend, and I have a piece up at American Spectator today talking about this, the media, CNN, MSNBC, everybody else, they were practically running with cameras and microphones to the nation's capital for this rally of the alt-right. And they get there, and there's only 2,000 people there. I mean, that was it.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, and yet there are 40,000 to 50,000 people right now who are members of the Democratic Socialists of America, and people listening who are like, oh well, yeah, I'm a good member of the Democratic Party. I would never be a Democratic Socialist of America. Actually, there are a bunch of DSA people who are now running as Democrats. One of them is Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, 28 years old, and she defeated a Democrat in the Democratic primary in New York. She's going to run virtually unopposed in November. So basically right there, you're going to have a Democratic Socialist member of the House of Representatives, although she's running as a Democrat. And in my backyard in Western PA, I have two of them, Summer Lee and Sarah Inamorato, who are both Democratic Socialists of America members, and they ran as Democrats in the Democratic primary, and they won. So I would tell people on the Democratic side, you think Republicans have an alt-right problem? I don't think they do at all. I would say Democrats have an alt-left problem.
Paul, when I think of the socialist agenda, all I keep hearing is, hey, everyone, free stuff.
Right. Yeah, that's exactly right. And studies that have been done on this subject, Gallup has done a few, the Reason Foundation, the group Victims of Communism Memorial Foundation, they'll find millennials in particular saying really positive things about communism or about socialism. Or I think the latest survey, Bill, from Gallup was 44% of millennials say they prefer socialism and 42% prefer capitalism. And, of course, they answer this on their phones and their computers and all these things that capitalism has given them that you would have never seen in the communist bloc, and, you know, which aren't exactly in abundance in Venezuela and Zimbabwe and North Korea and Cuba today. But when you dig deeper and you ask them, well, how do you define socialism? How do you define communism? They just give you these fuzzy platitudes, these feel-good slogans like, oh, it's about people helping one another. Mm-hmm. It's about sharing, right? It's about sharing wealth. Actually, it's not about sharing wealth at all. It's about forcing people to give up their, not just their wealth, but their property at gunpoint. And you know, one of the things that drives me crazy is when you hear kind of social justice Christians saying, oh, well, the Gospels talk about a form of communism, right? They talk about sharing. And yeah, but that's totally different. Sharing of your wealth because you want to help your neighbor and sacrificially and charitably doing what Jesus would do is completely different from, you know, going to the state and at gunpoint telling people they have no right to inheritance, they have no right to private property, and that 90% of your wealth will be taken away in forced confiscation from the government. I mean, that, you know, there's nothing charitable and Christian about that. Jesus wants to give us to give of what we have voluntarily, not by order of the state,
right,
but threat of imprisonment.
Right.
I mean, that's not Christian communism or Christian socialism. People who say that kind of stuff have it completely backward.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Paul Kengor is my guest. His book, The Politically Incorrect Guide to Communism, is a book that just came out. We're going to take a little break and continue with Paul in just a minute. Welcome back. Dr. Paul Kengor is my guest. He's written a book called The Politically Incorrect Guide to Communism. Paul, I want to talk about getting into faith and socialism and communism, how this all works together. It seems that Jesus spent a lot of time caring for the poor. He maybe wouldn't have been for the greedy corporations. He was always trying to say, let's take care of the poor and the needy. So a lot of people think, well, I bet Jesus was a socialist.
Right, right. Well, and he also defended property rights. And I mean, you know, look at some of the parables, right, including some of the parables that people struggle with a vineyard owner and so forth, right? And you're paying people who came at the end of the day the same wage as people earlier in the day. And some might see that as paying everybody an equal wage, but some also see it as the right of a property owner to pay people as he sees fit. And of course, the very commandment, "Thou shalt not steal," implies that people have private property, right? That's a basic property.
Great point.
Right?
Yeah,
yeah.
Great.
But if you actually read the Communist Manifesto, which I would advise people to do, I mean, don't worry, you're not going to be converted. I assure you. It's a horrible, horrible book, but you'll see in there that Marx and Engels talk about, you know, what is communism but the most radical rupture in traditional relations. They talk about abolition of the family. They talk about abolition of religion. They talk about the repudiation of all morality. So you know, that is one of the most atheistic, anti-Christian manifestos that you'll see anywhere. So I would strongly caution people, you know, just because communism involved redistribution of wealth, which was forced by the state, And just because the Gospels talk about sharing with people, I mean, that's like saying, you know, my house and the Taj Mahal are exactly equal because they're both houses or something, right? I mean, mm-hmm. it's just a massive leap. I've heard people say before, Bill, well, you have certain religious orders. There are monks there that have communal living and so forth. Yeah, that's right. But they also, you know, pray all day long. You know, they don't hate religion.
Uh-huh.
They don't call religion the opiate of the masses. They're not going next door to a convent of nuns and you know, executing them. You know, like the Soviets did, like Lenin and the boys did. So it's a completely different thing.
Yeah, Paul. When did communism first gain momentum?
Well, that's a good question. The Communist Manifesto was published in 1848, and I guess you'd have to say when it really took power and took flight, if you will, was 1917. That was the Bolsheviks, Lenin, Trotsky, and Stalin, who again eventually, you know, first called themselves the Social Democratic Labor Party of Russia. And then from there, it would always spread by force. I mean, the people of Eastern Europe, where it really went next, they never voted communists into power. And if you could ever find a case where communists were voted into power, they certainly didn't allow for free and fair elections again after that. And instead, they did things like built walls around their country, not to keep people from coming in, who were just dying to go in there and, you know, lap up that wonderful, you know, redistribution of wealth. The walls were built to keep their own people from escaping to other countries. Look at Cuba. This is one of my favorite examples, Bill. Cuba, if you look at satellite photos of Cuba, you will see an island without boats.
Crazy.
Without boats. Yeah, the fishing industry was the first industry there under the strictest surveillance, because people got in boats and they left. It's an island where fishing is banned and where swimming is banned, because people will actually jump in the water and try to swim 80 miles to Key West in shark-infested waters. I mean, that's how much the people who live under communism, who live under real socialism, or as Hugo Chavez, who admired Castro so much that he died in Cuba, or went to Cuba for health care treatment. Chavez called it 21st century socialism, which you see really just looks like 20th century communism.
Paul, every communist regime is also atheist, right?
That's right. And they had, I share with my students testimony that was given by the head of Communist Party USA, William Z. Foster, in the 1930s, to our Congress. And one of the congressmen, Hamilton Fish, actually asked him, he says, can somebody be a member of Communist Party USA and be a Christian, be a believer? And Foster kind of tiptoed around the question because he was answering in public and he was under oath. And he said, let me just say, it would be frowned upon by the party and would be very difficult. And then he basically said, Bill, I don't know why anybody who would be a Christian would want to be a communist, right?
Mm-hmm.
And in the Soviet Union and these other countries, you did swear an atheistic loyalty oath saying that you were not a Christian. You weren't allowed to hold party positions and be a Christian. Boris Yeltsin talked about that. Mikhail Gorbachev talked about that. So they genuinely saw Christianity as the opiate of the masses. And as Marx put it, communism begins where atheism begins. Communism begins where atheism begins. That's how Marx put it.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to play dumb right now, maybe just because I am dumb. But what is the death toll from communism?
Well, the standard estimate that's used by the Black Book of Communism, which was the Harvard University Press book that was published in 1999, end of the 20th century, And it's now used by Victims of Communism Memorial Foundation in Washington, which was established and passed, I think, overwhelmingly, I think unanimously, by Democrats and Republicans in Congress. They use the number of 100 million. But that number looks like it's got to be at least 140 million because, for example, they only attributed about 20 million to the Soviet Union, only, right? Only 20 million. It looks like the latest numbers on the Soviet Union, it looks like Stalin alone, in the words of Alexander Yakovlev, annihilated 60 to 70 million people. So you could have 140 million just between Stalin and Mao's China. And then that doesn't even include all the Iron Curtain countries, Cuba, Ethiopia, North Korea, you know, on and on and on. So it's probably more like 140 million. And whether it's 100 million or 140 million, that would be, Bill, that would constitute about double the combined death tolls of World War I and World War II. And it would utterly dwarf Hitler's genocide as well.
Yeah, Paul, I'm going to stay on my I think I'm kind of dumb theme here. How do you eliminate 100 million people?
That's a good question. And people that are listening right now, think about this. When if you're at home or wherever, pull out a calculator. Calculate, go from 1917 to 1999, and really most of those deaths occurred between 1917 and 79. And just punch in 100 million and figure out how many people that would be a year and how many people that would be a day. And then you'll look at those numbers and you'll say, I don't see how they even did it. How can you kill this many people?
Right.
It was the deadliest ideology in history. Ronald Reagan said that communism is a disease. Worse than that, he said it's a form of insanity. And disease, it's actually hard to find diseases that killed that many people in that span of time.
Mm-hmm.
It really is.
Mm-hmm. Paul, is your new book a light, medium, or heavy read?
Well, The Politically Incorrect Guide to Communism is an easy read. We have sidebars. We have jokes. I mean, you got to joke through this, Bill, right? Otherwise, you're going to be sitting there crying on every page. And it was really written in a kind of a fun and even as fun can be when you're talking about all this death.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of sarcasm. And I really wanted something here that young people in particular, and especially homeschooled kids and K-12 kids, could read and understand.
Yeah, so I want to just let our listeners know that if Paul Kengor wrote it, you're going to want to read it. And the book is The Politically Incorrect Guide to Communism, one of many books that Paul has written. And Paul, I just love having you on the show. So thank you for saying yes, and thank you for making it on the show today.
Anytime, Bill. You guys call me anytime.
I will indeed. Thanks so much. Dr. Paul Kengor has been my guest. We'll take a little break, and we'll be back with more. Patrick Albanese is going to be up next on the program. We'll be back in just a few minutes.
Children even exist anymore? For the Colson Center, I'm John Stone Street with The Point. Recently, I told you about Belgian doctors euthanizing children as young as 9 who've requested to die due to reportedly terminal illnesses. Writing in the Washington Post, Charles Lane offers powerful reasons why Belgium and any other country considering euthanasia laws should put on the brakes and fast. Doctors who make the determination about whether a child is competent to request death do so in private. The public and the media can't investigate. Lane also points out that we don't allow children to vote or legally consent to sex, and yet they're old enough to consent to physician-assisted suicide. And if children in the U.S. can consent to receive puberty-blocking hormones to become transgender, is it such a huge leap to allow them to consent to, say, sex? Belgium is further down the road than the U.S., but this road is looking more and more like a slippery slope. Both countries need to turn around now. For more on faith and culture, come to breakpoint.org. I'm John Stone Street.
It is 32 minutes after the hour. If you're just climbing into your car, I hope your day at work went well, and I hope you've got a nice evening plan. Thank you for tuning in. We've had a great conversation with Dr. Paul Kengor. We just got off the phone with him, and he's written a new book on the Politically Incorrect Guide to Communism. Kind of nice summer reading if you're still looking for something to read this summer. Patrick Albanese, my friend and colleague from prestigious West Des Moines, is already on the Skype line. We're going to bring him on in just a minute. I do want to encourage you to call and leave a voicemail of reading a scripture verse, because we want to try to get as many voices as we can on the show. You don't have to introduce yourself or say your name. You can just say, hey, I want to read scripture for Bill's show. And then you name the chapter and verse and then read it, and then we're good to go. Our friend Al from New Brighton did that. So here's Al with a scripture verse.
Isaiah chapter 45 and verse 18. For thus says the Lord, who created the heavens, who is God, who formed the earth and made it, who has established it, who did not create it in vain, who formed it to be inhabited. I am the Lord and there is no other.
Experiencing not just information, but transformation.
It's been such an encouragement to receive so much practical wisdom and see people who are really living for God with all their heart and soul and mind and strength. And, it's been such an encouragement for me through various struggles and getting free from various sins. And I think probably the biggest benefit of all listening over these years has just been more passion to seek the Lord myself and my life.
Faith Radio.
What would you do with a brain if you had one?
Do? Why, if I had a brain, I could
while away the hours, conferring with the flowers, consulting with the rain. And my head, I'd be scratching while my thoughts were busy hatching if I only had a brain.
That music belongs to Patrick Albanese, my friend and colleague from prestigious West Des Moines. We've been friends for a long time. We work in the same business, in the entertainment business, for years and years and years and years. And Patrick has been a part of Triple Espresso for, I think, going on 17 or 18 years. And he is just a dear friend and a regular guest of the show. And he's with us now. Hello, Patrick.
Hello. Yeah, being in the same business, we are unemployed together a lot.
That's right. So on this day in 1889, William Gray patented the coin-operated telephone. I'm sad to say Mr. Gray's invention and patent is largely obsolete today.
Wow.
Do you remember getting off planes and racing for the bank of phones?
Yes. I remember you driving through, you know, a neighborhood and you'd say, oh boy, I got a call. I'm lost.
Right.
And you go, I got to find a phone. And of course you're always lost in one of those neighborhoods that when you find a phone booth, there's a cord, but there's very rarely a phone attached to it anymore. It's not gonna be the best place to stop and make a phone call.
Yeah. But you know, as annoying as cell phones can be, they are pretty amazing.
Yeah, well, you know, they are wonderful, and it makes long drives pretty tolerable, although I like the long drive. And I kind of miss that, getting in the car, and you say, I'm just cut off from the world.
Yeah.
And, you know, you didn't have satellite radio or anything like that, so you're driving through New Mexico, and you get nothing except peace of mind. And, you know, it's probably a good time to think of, the gentleman that just called in, Al.
Al, yeah.
Al doing a great job reading the Bible verse. My favorite of the people that have called in was that kid Linus that called in and did that one that they used in that Christmas special with Charlie Brown. Should have that. You know, Linus That's, called in and you yeah. should play that.
Yeah, Luke chapter 2.
Yeah. Oh, but cell phones have made things. You know, I always say with every innovation comes irritation. And the cell phone, with all of the innovation and all the great things, it brings a ton of irritation as well. So you got to find that goofy balance.
Which... Yeah, I remember, and you probably as well, you know, your dad would go to the office and then he would be driving home and then that would be it. His workday was pretty much over.
Yeah.
And you drove home and then you came to your family and the kids would pile on you and, you know, like that was it. Now... You can talk on the phone the whole way home. You can do business the whole way home. And then you can do business at night because people are getting to your cell phone 24 hours a day.
And they're online. We had a rule. If the phone rang during dinner, you couldn't answer it.
Right. Oh, absolutely.
And of course, you know, we didn't have an answering machine, so it would just ring and it would ring and ring. And
you didn't take it off the hook?
No, we didn't take it off the hook because, you know, if you took it off the hook after about 30 seconds, you get that. Remember that thing? Remember that noise?
I don't think I ate a meal without hearing that noise.
Yeah. So it would just be let it ring, leave it. You had to remember you had to make those. If you had friends, one of my close friends, we did all of our talking on the phone because he lived far enough away, 17 miles away, where that was considered long distance call. That was out of the zone.
Oh, funny.
And so you had to call late at night to get the discount rate.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
We used to talk 2 a.m. If I was going to call my friend, I'd have to call him at 2:00 a.m. partly to get the discount rate, partly to, you know, fool my mom into thinking it wasn't me making those calls. 2:00 a.m, Mom, come on.
Yeah. All right. There's a little firing that went on today. It looks like Peter Strzok has been fired from the FBI. You think
yes.
It's about time?
Well, first off, you know, I would have never hired the guy because if you cannot pronounce your last name the way that it's spelled, I don't trust you.
There's a lot of consonants jammed together at once, and that doesn't make a lot of sense.
Strzok?
Yeah.
Strzok? Wait, that's Sturzok.
There's some silent consonants in there.
Yeah, it's worse than French. I mean, the French, I don't think they pronounce half the letters in their languages. What are these? These are useless. So, and he's already got a GoFundMe set up, and
oh.
It's already generating some money. But see, do you remember when Andrew McCabe got fired?
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of these guys are getting fired. McCabe got fired. He had a GoFundMe and it got to, I think, $500,000 pretty quickly. And then people started to realize, oh boy, he's in actual real trouble because he actually did commit real crimes, and the funding started to dry up. And I think Sturzok, we'll just call him that. I think he had to get this GoFundMe started right away because, I think some dirt's going to come out. Why, if they fire him, like, why now? It's been 2 years, and I'm thinking, well, they fired him now because more stuff is coming and they don't need him anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And they kept him in the employ of the FBI so they could keep an eye on him and control him. Because now he can, you know, he can go on Twitter and he can do whatever he wants to do, and he can be like James Comey, who, you know, tweets nasty things about the president. But if they've let him go, I'm thinking, that could be very bad for him. It might mean that they got bigger fish to fry and he is no longer necessary.
And now his testimony, Patrick, was a little different from his girlfriend, Lisa Page's.
Yes. I think that's part of his problem.
I think that is part of his problem.
Yeah. And especially when you have members of Congress saying, well, she's quite the credible witness. You go, I think I know which horse they're backing.
Mm-hmm.
They like Lisa Page. So I think she must have contradicted a lot of what he had to say, which also makes you think that she is a cooperating witness and has decided that she would not like to go to jail. And ergo, she will help them put other people in jail first.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it looks like.
Mm-hmm. And then what do you know about this woman that was fired that apparently has got dirt on President Trump?
Omarosa.
Omarosa, yeah. Sounds like Ponderosa.
Ponderosa, yeah. Have you listened to, and even you should have Rebecca chime in on this thing. Have you listened to she played a recording the other day on television where she secretly recorded General Kelly, which I'm thinking is probably never a good idea to secretly record a general.
I would agree. But,
yeah, if you've heard the recording, and I'm going to guess that Rebecca is, and the reason why I'm bringing Rebecca into this is it is the clearest, most beautiful, darn near studio quality produced recording ever. So however she hid this microphone, it sounds like it was edited, processed, that they took all the, let's take the ums and the ahs out of that. And the beautiful thing about it is General Kelly is saying, you know, calm down. You're being let go for some serious ethical violations. In the meantime, while he's saying this, she's secretly recording this guy in a secure facility, which, as I understand it, is a serious ethical violation. So you go, this was probably a very good fire.
Ethical violation or not, I need lessons on exactly how to get the audio to sound that clear.
Have you? Okay, Rebecca. So you heard it. Did you hear? It was spectacularly crystal clear.
It sounds as if you were really good. Although, I mean, I suppose they could have cleaned it up before they released it. But that's it. It's really nice, actually. Like I said, I'm gonna get some lessons.
Yeah, it's unlike any secret recording I've ever made.
Which you may or may not admit to live on the air.
Well, I should never put the microphone in the potted plant, you know, under the dirt. But that's
right. That's You're not the brightest guy we have on the show.
I'm not
so
good
you know.
At surreptitious activity.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
So why she got hired in the first place, I don't know. You know, maybe Trump had a difficult time finding people he trusted, which is evidently this is another one to put in there. And people seem to love to record him. Either they think he's going to say something that they can extort money out of him later. You know, I think a lot of people go into these White House jobs looking down the road saying, I'll put in my time. And then when I go on the book tour and get the job on television, I'm going to be rich and it'll be worth doing it. And it sounds like Omarosa decided to try and make that happen faster. But not a good hire.
Yeah, not a good hire. And I understand that she was apparently, from what I read, there was some tears and I don't want to lose my job, and it's a little bit of a mixed bag.
Yeah, and it also makes you wonder if they must have known she was doing some secret recording. And you can get into conspiracy land, which is, by the way, open 24 hours a day now.
Yeah.
And most conspiracies, a lot of people don't know this, most of these conspiracy theories are actually put together by the same couple of guys. It's Elvis and JFK. They do it from Area 51 with using technology they got from some of the UFOs they took down. That's where most conspiracies are birthed. But one of the conspiracies is that, oh, this is a plant, that this is actually a recording that they purposely made only to get the media to chew on something and go crazy for a couple of days. But, I haven't seen the media this angry since yesterday.
Yeah, yesterday they were awfully mad. All right, yeah, Patrick, let me take a short break. When we come back, more with Patrick Albanese. It is 15 minutes until the top of the hour. It is 13 minutes until the top of the hour. Patrick Albanese, my friend and colleague from prestigious West Des Moines, is my guest. And Patrick, we're supposed to love our neighbor, but do you ever, like, intentionally avoid your neighbor?
But not my current neighbors. Actually, the one neighbor.
I mean, do you ever see somebody and you go, well, I think I'm just going to avoid them?
Yeah, I do. There, my one neighbor, I would say I do a tremendous act of charity for every fall, is I rake her leaves for her. Yeah, I do that. And then I throw them back over the fence into her yard, because it's like, if these are going to fall in my yard, we can't be neighbors. You trim those trees. I remember one time you had some noisy neighbors.
I had noisy neighbors, yeah. Yeah, it's a difficult call at times. I mean, you want to be loving and gracious, but you also want to not be bothered by too much noise.
Well, yeah, I think it's easier to love your neighbors if you first get to pick your neighbors. You know, if you don't get to, sometimes you're thrust into, say an apartment complex and you say, I did not pick these neighbors. I'm struggling here. But as we both know, the loving the lovable is easy.
Yes, exactly. But I mean, Jesus calls us to love our neighbor. And I think in this world, in this very toxic environment that we call society right now, it is increasingly more difficult and a little bit more of a struggle. Am I right?
Yeah. It certainly seems like people, you look around and you say, come on, do we have to be angry about everything? Everything's politicized. Like I saw, Disney's casting their first gay character in a movie, and now people are upset because they said, but you're not using a gay actor to play the to the play the gay character. So now you've upset us, even though we applaud that you're doing the other thing. But now we're still mad. You see, you can't make people happy. And in fact, I think it's gotten so bad that for the Walking Dead show now, they have to actually cast real zombies. Like they can't use actors anymore. They have to use real zombies.
Yeah.
You say, well, you're looking to be upset. And so how do you make peace with that?
Just the everyday level of outrage that, I mean, you even sent me a message that someone posted on Facebook saying that they just walked through first class.
Yes.
And they were just disturbed by the number of the ratio of men to women in first class. It's like they're mad about that.
That was a friend of mine, and she said it was about 70. I think it was two to one ratio of men to women, and or worse, maybe 80% men and 20% women. And she just thought that this was a horrific injustice. You know, I tend to look at it and say, well, it just says that women are a lot smarter when it comes to buying airline tickets, saying I'm not spending $1,200 for 2 inches of room.
Exactly. But in this environment that we're in, do you have a suggestion as to how we can better put these differences aside and this low-level anger and rage and be better at loving our neighbors?
Well, I don't know if I have the world's best suggestion. I know what I try to do is I do try to be a lot more patient about things. You know, I have kind of a 48-hour news rule when something comes out, especially if it's something that feels as if it's manipulating your emotions. I say you got to wait a couple of days for the truth to come out. And I feel that way about a lot of things when I'm getting more emotionally involved. I say, yeah, hang on a second. My emotions are getting involved here, which means chances are I'm going to maybe say something I regret or act out because I'm angry at something. Settle down. You don't know the entire story about, you know, like with your neighbor. Have you ever had those experiences where you say, oh, I had no idea that, you know, you were in a scooter and actually couldn't get out there and rake your own leaves.
Right.
The next thing, you know. My neighbor disappeared. My one neighbor disappeared for a while. And it only upset me because normally when he cuts his grass, he would cut the side part of my grass on the one side of the driveway. So I didn't have to do it. And suddenly I started thinking, boy, Ted's really dropped the ball. I've been cutting my grass and I hadn't seen him for like 5-6 weeks. And I see him and he doesn't look so good. He says, oh, I had a, you know, quintuple bypass. I'm like, I am so sorry. Can I come over and cut your grass for you?
I know.
I got it covered. You know, my son-in-law's coming over to cut it. I said, good. Could you have him cut that part by my side of the parkway, on my side of the driveway? Really appreciate it. But, you know, I didn't know. And it wasn't that I wasn't mad at him. I thought, wow, 5 weeks.
Yeah.
I should have been knocking on his door.
Oh, I know, Patrick. And it reminds me of Stephen Covey's book, The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. And I think the second one is seek first to understand, then to be understood. That might be a good thing to do as followers of Christ, to not overreact to anything, but to seek to understand first.
Yeah, yeah. The neighbor on the other side of me has adopted 4 children from Russia. None of them work in the Trump administration. But you know, when she would first get these kids, and some of them were 5, 6, 7 years old, I'd say, gosh, she's got some really strange kids. I can't make – they don't speak right.
Mm-hmm.
They actually were speaking Russian. You know, if I had taken some time to actually talk to my neighbor, which I did, and she says, well, yeah, Nick is from Russia. I just got back with him. It cost me a fortune, but it's – you know, my heart breaks when I hear about some of the situations these kids are in. I'm like, my gosh, I love my neighbor. She's the best. You know. Yeah, take some time.
Yeah.
Seek first, understand. That's really good stuff.
It is good stuff. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a classic thing that you should have lodged in your brain all the time, because I always first want to take action or respond to something clearly before knowing what's going on in a person's world. And, of course, I'm haunted by the idea that, you know, you hear of stories of people that, you know, they don't come out of their house for weeks and weeks, and all of a sudden you find out they died and they were – no one discovered him for a week, and you go, really? That's a neighbor. Yeah. And I never knocked on the door. I never asked, how are you? I haven't seen you in a while. I mean, yeah. Talk about just constant guilt.
You know, when I lived in California, I lived in the same apartment for over 20 years. And I realized, gosh, I hardly know my neighbors. Now, apartment complexes can be pretty transient, but I knew one neighbor that lived next door because they were the managers. So, you know, I had to drop off a rent check. I got to know them pretty well. And I moved to Iowa, and I don't think we were in this house for 2 days before there's knocks on the doors with, you know, baskets and cakes and welcome things. And now I have I look around and I say, oh, I know all these people, this sense of community. This is really a better way to live. It's really a better way to live. And which you just made me feel more guilty for not knocking on Ted's door and saying, where have you been?
That was my goal, to rub it in a little bit.
Ted put you up to this, didn't he? Yeah.
He did. He did. But I think I want to be encouraging all listeners to, including myself, and I'm preaching this little sermon to myself, is what does it take to spend an extra 5 or 10 seconds? I will sometimes, not take those 10 seconds to greet a neighbor or to try to initiate a conversation. You know, sometimes you'll see a neighbor and they'll be purposely, they look so busy that they can't be interrupted. And what they're doing is hoping you don't have a conversation with them, probably.
Yeah, there was one guy, I've been guilty of this. He walks down the street with his dog, and I'm like, oh, there's Al, different Al than the one that called earlier. And he's the friendliest guy, but he's very chatty. So you need 10 minutes.
Yeah, right.
And so in a way, I say to myself, all right, are you in such a huge hurry to get somewhere that you can't chat with Al for 10 minutes?
Mm-hmm.
He is your neighbor. But I'm guilty of it. It's like, get in the car, hurry up out of the driveway. Oops, I hit Al. Now I have to talk to him.
Yeah, now you got to exchange insurance information and all that.
Yeah. So it's great. Well, we're selfie absorbed. You know, we take selfies. We have somebody say, could you take a picture of me taking a picture of me?
Right.
Because I'd really like to get what it looks like when I'm taking it. Do you know when Neil Armstrong, the guy walks on the moon, right?
Mm-hmm.
He took 5 pictures.
When he was on the moon?
Yeah. He took 5, and his face is not in a single one of them. She's like, well, that's interesting. Over there. And you really, you know, 5 pictures of the moon pretty much does it because there's not a whole lot going on.
But if you're on the moon, you pretty much want to document that you're up there. I would have been holding the camera myself.
He didn't take, you know, so his face is, these days people, they take 37 pictures of their dessert and their face is in every last one of them. The dessert's going in their mouth.
Yeah.
Neil Armstrong makes it to the moon, says, well, I should probably get a couple of pictures while I'm here. You know, it's like you and me making it to the Grand Canyon going, well, while we're here, might as well take a couple of photos.
Yeah.
Hey, you've done that, haven't you? I traveled around the country once. I come back. I get my film developed. I said, no people, all buildings. Here's New York City. Here's a building. Here's a building in Jersey. And I was so disappointed. I said, I didn't take any pictures of people.
Yeah, and those pictures pretty much don't make much sense anymore. They don't. You really don't care too much about them.
I can't place most of them.
Yeah.
I don't know if I'm in Oklahoma. I don't know where I am.
Yeah. So, Patrick, what's the takeaway for tonight? Let's try to figure out a way to be more loving to our neighbors. And that probably starts next door. And just to remind ourselves to take that extra 5 or 10 seconds to initiate a conversation, because you don't know what might come of it. And if you want to imitate Christ, you open the door to friendship by just being nice.
Yeah. If it seems inconvenient, you might want to do it.
Isn't that the truth in life?
Yeah.
Yeah.
If you're being just a little bit selfish with your time, it's like, oh, what's a couple of minutes here and there? Stop and chat with people.
Yeah. All right. Patrick, thanks so much for
that. Said that, you know, you should go to other people's funerals because if you don't go to theirs, they won't come to yours.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thanks for doing the show. Have a great evening. I'll talk to you next week.
Alrighty.
All right. Thank you, Patrick Albanese, and thank you to Dr. Paul Kengor. What a great hour. That wraps up our show for tonight. Have a great evening, everyone. I'll see you tomorrow. Thanks for listening. Programming like this is made available through your support. Information available at myfaithradio.com.